yeah, we back up in this, y'all. Hey, it's me, Patrick. Welcome to the show once again. We have another interview. Now, I said this several weeks ago, a while back, but when we were getting started, we just had lots and lots of interview conversations with so many different people, and we just want to start sharing those right away. And then in the coming weeks, you'll have some pop culture panel episodes, more homilies, more quote episodes. And so it's going to be a lot of fun when we continue to roll this thing out. But today, we have Lindsay Crinks. This sister is a bad one, man. She is incredible. Lindsay is one of my favorite humans on planet Earth. She's a street chaplain here in Nashville. She has a love, compassion, hope, and justice filled nature about her. I think you're going to love this episode. So buckle up, tune it up loud, get ready to share this to all of the humans that you know. All of them. Share it with all of them. Also, if you haven't already, like the podcast on iTunes and follow us on Instagram. But yeah, that's it. Let's get to Lindsay. But before I guess we get to Lindsay, Ben, it's going to be about some food, I'm sure. But Ben, what's happening over there?
It's not directly about food, but it is. It's a lot. I mean, it has food in it, but it's more of a fact about an interesting law in our neighbor state, Kentucky.
Ooh, Wildcats.
So as of
or Louisville.
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 It's Louisville. So
Cardinals.
As of the publishing of this blog that I'm seeing this on, this could have changed by now. I'm not fact checking these really hard. But as of the publishing of this, it is illegal to carry an ice cream cone in your back pocket in Kentucky.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Which is a bummer.
Here's Lindsay. Enjoy the show. Well, here we are.
Hi.
Hey. So we're here with my friend Lindsay, and I'm excited to have you.
Excited to be here.
Show.
Yeah.
So kind of what's been the, I guess, protocol that we've done with these interviews is to just hear, because I'm just bringing on people that I think are interesting, that have interesting stories and journeys and perspectives, insight, etc. And I think you are at the top of that list. So I guess we'll start off with just who are you?
Yeah.
A little bit of background, and then we'll kind of see where we go.
Absolutely. Well, I'll start off by saying that I wear a few different hats in the community. One is I help co-found Open Table Nashville, which is an interfaith homeless outreach organization.
That's right.
I've worked with a lot of other nonprofits too, but co-founded that one. So the hats that I wear are the homeless outreach hat, helping people get into housing, the street chaplaincy hat, which is really looking at that deeper sense of healing, the education hat. So I do a lot of work around educating folks, and I've also done a lot of community organizing. So that's like not just healing the wounds of people, but healing the wounds of broken systems.
Right.
And that work toward justice and liberation. So,
man. So give us the, how did it all start? Like you're from where are you from? How'd you get to Nashville? Like, how did all this start for you?
Yeah, so I grew up in the foothills of South Carolina. I spent a lot of time turning over river rocks and playing outside all the chances I could get. I grew up in the Church of Christ, in a really supportive family, but I also saw, you know, the darkness of addiction and mental health issues early on. Had a lot of uncles and cousins who struggled with those issues and then ended up going on and off the streets, in and out of jail, treatment facilities. So there's a dark edge to that too. And when I was 18, I was like, you know, I'm getting out of here. I'm getting out of this.
Right.
I wanted to come to Nashville to Lipscomb. So I came here to start. And my plan, I had a plan all figured out. And my plan was to be a physical therapist and have a very comfortable life with the white picket fence, the 2.5 kids, plenty of vacation time, the whole nine yards. My plan was to have a comfortable life. I wanted to get out of the discomfort.
Right.
But you know, I knew I was called to healing early on because I was drawn to physical therapy.
Sure, yeah.
But I just didn't know. As a female in the Church of Christ, I didn't think there were many paths for me in what I really wanted to do. So I went with that path. But when I was at Lipscomb, a few different things happened. One of the things that happened was I started reading the prophets and actually reading the Gospels. And I realized that the prophets weren't just talking about charity. They were talking about justice.
Right.
Let justice roll down.
Absolutely.
And I realized that Jesus was one of the most radical examples I'd ever seen. And I actually didn't see a lot of people in the church living like Jesus. And I was so drawn in by the ways that I was feeling called to not just preach gospel, but to embody good news to the poor. What does it mean to embody good news to the poor? What does it mean to actually follow that example and go the places today that I think Jesus and the prophets would be going and be a part of the work that I think they were about during their time. So that really rocked my boat. And then I realized that, you know, through not only the work of my studies, but also realizing how widespread poverty and homelessness were and hunger is across the globe, but also in our own backyard.
Right.
This quote hit me, I remember, it was my senior year when I was starting to realize, you know, maybe I'm not called to physical therapy. Maybe there's this something else that's calling me. I could feel this pull that I didn't know what it was. And this quote said, you know, we're called to be faithful, not comfortable, yeah, as people of faith and conscience.
Yeah.
And being faithful for me meant stepping out of that plan that I didn't really have control of anyway.
Mm.
Also had, you may remember, we went to college around,
right?
I mean, I was
same,
there when you were there.
Same time, yeah.
But I was on crutches forever because I had a terrible, I was that girl on crutches for like over a year.
Yeah.
Because I had a terrible ankle injury.
That's right.
Yeah. And what happens when you go through something profound and you're dependent on somebody else for every single thing, even carrying your lunch tray and driving you to the grocery store,
yeah,
is that you realize, you know, we all are a lot more vulnerable than we pretend to be. And it just takes one thing to change our lives. So that broke me down. And there's a Carmelite nun who once said, it's the crushed heart that's the soft heart, the tender heart. Yeah. So that broke me open. And then my senior year, after I ran into that quote, after I'd struggled with the ankle injury, I was actually skipping class. So
nice.
Being a model student, model senior with
senioritis.
Classic
senior, yeah.
I was skipping class and went with a couple friends to an art gallery downtown. And I literally stumbled upon the offices of this group called the Nashville Homeless Power Project. And they were a group of not just people that were fighting for, like, you know, crumbs from the table. They were currently homeless, formerly homeless folks that were fighting for a place at the table. That's justice. And they were organizing around affordable housing. I couldn't believe when I ran into their office, they invited me in. I invited them to campus. They became my mentors.
Wow.
And that kind of took me to the underside of Nashville and showed me a picture that I'd never seen. And it confirmed that I was called to a different kind of healing ever since I've been on the streets. That was 2007.
That was obviously a big moment.
Huge.
Walking into that office.
Huge.
So, and I'm curious if there was like an actual moment, conversation, experience, or I mean something had to have happened before you even hit that quote that made you start thinking, I don't know if the life I have set forth is gonna be the one that's for me. Was there something like that happened?
It was like this seed that was planted. I think it happened you know, when I had the ankle injury.
Okay.
We did this thing called, you know, at Lipscomb, the 30-hour famine, which was to raise a lot of awareness about global poverty and hunger. And I think it was in the time of fasting, in that time of reading the prophets Isaiah talk about the kind of fast I want is to break the chains of injustice and untie the cords of the yoke. That's how I want my people to be living.
Right.
Things like that planted a seed in me that just grew. It just bloomed. It rooted deeply, and it's still rooting in me.
Yeah.
It hasn't gone away. It's like a fire in my bones, and I can't hold it in. I can't hold it back.
Yeah.
So that spark was planted then, I think, and just grew.
That's great. So, okay, you said at the top, you know, you were a part of the team of people that started Open Table. So you have these mentors,
mm-hmm.
you know, pretty much right after school, then you kind of launch into this kind of journey of like, what does this look like for me to do this thing?
Yeah.
So take me from like that moment, graduating, and then basically how did you all get to this thing called Open Table?
Yeah, so it was a really fun conversation when I told my parents.
So,
hey, Mom and Dad. So remember this thing I was going to do that was going to be really stable and really awesome?
Mm-hmm,
I'm not
mm-hmm.
going to do that anymore because I really think I'm being called to something else. They were like, what?
Yeah.
My mom sent me like Oprah self-defense tips for a long time. She was like, she'd email me these like little things.
Oh, so good.
So that was really fun. And they were really as open and supportive as they could be. But, you know, it doesn't, sometimes when you follow your calling, it's not like a linear path, right?
Right.
You're like fumbling around for a while. So I worked a ton of odd jobs. I worked at a museum. I nannied. I worked at a bookstore. I did whatever I could to volunteer as much as I could to get experience, to get the relationships and network. And then I did AmeriCorps for 2 years, which is like the domestic equivalent of the Peace Corps.
Mm-hmm.
You live on poverty level wages. So I lived on like under $10,000 a year. And you do full-time work on poverty issues. So I did that for 2 years. And then I went to grad school at Vanderbilt Divinity School. At the same exact time, we were starting Open Table, and I would not recommend starting a nonprofit the same time you go to grad school. It was poor timing on my part. You don't really time that. But with the AmeriCorps job, I was in the tent cities. I was on uh-huh. the streets. I was seeing people, meeting people, having my world rocked. And it was the most on the ground I think you can ever be. And those experiences so profoundly shaped me. We mm-hmm. founded Open Table because there was a hole in our community. There was
right.
no one doing homeless outreach with the systemic justice framework and nobody that was doing that work that can mobilize the faith communities into that work. And we wanted to do that.
Wow. So you've been in this work now. How long has Open Table been? What year are we on?
Open Table's in its 8th year. I'm in my 11th year of this work. So it's been a minute.
Yeah. And so when you all started this thing called Open Table, was it kind of jarring to think that how has this not been happening already? Like, did you ask like faith communities, like, and other people who were like, why isn't this thing a thing? Like, and if so, what were the answers at the time that you were given that as to the why?
You know, we wanted to do something different, and that it didn't exist didn't really, we were in such a whirlwind. It was right after the flood hit here. Oh, there's tons of displacement from all
right.
the tent city stuff. So we didn't have a lot of time to sit back and be like, why isn't anyone else doing this? There are other amazing nonprofits doing amazing work, but that framework of justice is hard for
yeah.
a lot of people to grasp. When you're just doing the charity, it's easy to fund and it's easy to perpetuate, but really you're just perpetuating the need for yourself
mm-hmm.
if you're just continually giving those handouts. The work of justice means that sometimes you're going to take the side of the poor, take the side of your people, and that's going to be against people in power when they're fighting to maintain the status quo and their own power. It's not comfortable work. Again, we're called to be faithful, not comfortable.
Right.
The work of justice isn't like kumbaya. It is,
yeah.
It's hard work. We're pushing for systemic change, and we're pushing for our people to have a voice at our table, on our board, on our staff, in our education events that we do. We're not a voice for the voiceless. So it really kind of made sense that there weren't a lot of groups doing it because it's hard work. And you make a lot of friends, but they're the friends with no money, the friends on the bottom.
so now you've worked with a variety of faith communities.
Absolutely.
A variety of faith people.
Yeah.
And yet I can imagine that as you're saying, the justice piece is still a struggle for people.
Totally. And that's why we do education.
Yeah. How do you make sense of that? Like at least in your perspective, is here's why we struggle so much collectively, individually, with the justice piece. Like, what's the thing that's in the way of us getting to, like, okay, I'm all about justice work?
Totally. I think there's, when it comes to homelessness, I think there's a lot of stereotypes that are involved that mm-hmm. give a lot of people barriers. Some of us have bought into that myth that people are where they are because of the decisions they made. I remember buying into that myth when it was my uncles and my cousins.
Right.
But when I saw how widespread it was, I was like, something else is going on. And when I started looking at our society and looking at history, learning history, I started building a better analysis, a deeper analysis to see, oh, the federal government since the 80s has been cutting housing costs and increasing funding for jails. So we're actually funneling people into the jails when before we were providing a social safety net mm-hmm. through public housing funding and things like that. There are systemic reasons that there are so many people who are experiencing poverty. Our mental health care system has been gutted as well. You know, like right. our biggest mental health provider in Nashville is our jails. No question, everybody will tell you that, even the people in the jail working it.
Wow.
We have defunded these programs, and so it's funneling people into our jail system and into early death. We're burying people every few weeks. We're burying more of our people from the streets who are dying from unmet health needs, mental health stuff, being hit by cars. It's pretty grave work. So I think there's a lack of analysis. We drank the Kool-Aid that right. the people in power in our society were feeding us. And I think we also forget that those of us who are people of faith forget that in our prophets were pushing for justice too. They were not just pushing to share what you have. They're pushing. Amos says, like, you're like trampling the needy for a pair of sandals. Like, right. think about consumerism, what we just did with Black Friday or whatever, whenever, sure. whatever yeah. time of year. So I think there's a lot of barriers there, but some of it's analysis and some of it's just what our society perpetuates, because it perpetuates the status quo and keeping the same people in power. There's racial things in that too, as we all know.
Absolutely.
That a lot of people have drunk the Kool-Aid there as well.
Huh. So I guess that again, you're kind of touching on it, but maybe you have something more to add. But, you know, you're day in, day out. Mm-hmm. working with these men and women and families mm-hmm. that are living on the street, mm-hmm. What's the thing you wish more people, sure, in Nashville, we live in Nashville, Tennessee, but across the country, what you wish people knew, because you've experienced across the country kind of yeah. stuff, right? And so, like, what do you wish people knew about this population of people that they're still not, like, I wish you all could just understand this or these things. Like,
totally. There's yeah. a couple things. One is when I talk to groups about justice and understanding homelessness, I often talk to them about a plant growing in a garden. So I say, what does a plant need to grow in a garden? And people are like, water, sunlight, soil, what's in the soil, nutrients. When a plant's not thriving, I'm a gardener. When a mm-hmm. plant's not thriving and I care about that plant, I'm not going to rip it out and discard it and throw it away and say, you're a terrible tomato plant for not growing, right? right. Okay, that's what our society does when people don't thrive. We yeah. discard them. But I'm going to look at the conditions in which that plant is trying to grow. I'm going to say, is the sunlight right? Is it getting enough water? Are there enough nutrients in the soil? We've got to look at the broader conditions. How is the soil in our community? Do people have what they need when they're younger, growing up? Do they have the stability? Do they have the support? Do they have the care, the health care, mental health care that they need to flourish? Do we have the housing support for their families so they're not moving from hotel to hotel to their car? This trauma doesn't produce people who can thrive. There are certainly resiliencies in folks.
Mm-hmm.
But But I want people to know that the soil in our nation is toxic for the people on the bottom, for people who aren't white oftentimes, for people who have grown up in generational poverty. And it's not producing conditions in which they can thrive. The people who make it out are the exceptions.
Yeah.
A lot of people live their lives incarcerated, or their parents are incarcerated as they're growing up.
Yeah.
The system is toxic. So that's the justice part, is nurturing that soil so the plants have their best chance, the best possible chance they can to thrive.
Well, yeah, and I love that thing you pointed out about the exception. Like there's always that story of the one that came out of, you know, living on the streets, and now they're, you know, a CEO of a company.
Yeah.
And to me, I love the connection with that, with the gardening kind of analogy. It's like, okay, you made a really great sweet potato, but like, you just don't say, well, I'm done gardening. I made one really good sweet potato and I'm out. You know, it's like, but I feel like that's what we do. It's like, remember that time I made that one, I helped raise that one great sweet potato.
Yep.
It was really cool, wasn't it? And then just, now you have like a terrible garden now.
Yeah, and then the plague of aphids come in and destroy all your other crops.
Exactly.
We need to be tending the garden and like weeding it and nurturing the soil and pulling out the things that are attacking our plants.
Yeah,
so I want people to know that. And that goes into this trauma-informed care framework that a lot of people are using and talking about now. The conditions in which people are growing up inform their behaviors now. And we need to know that. The other thing I want people to know is there's a lot of darkness on the streets, but there's also a lot of light. And I've seen some of the most incredible things and met some of the most incredible people. And I wanted to tell you one story about, just the other night I was visiting with one of my friends who we housed a couple years ago, and he's doing really well, which makes me really happy.
Yeah,
he got out.
He
lived. He got out. But he remembers what it was like to be outside on the coldest nights. He remembers what the cold did to his body. And he leaned in as I was going to leave, and he said, you know, if you run across anybody this winter that has some of the same problems as me, you know, they don't like being in crowded shelters or whatever, just call me. They can stay at my place.
Wow.
It's kind of chilly here, but it heats up all right. And he was willing to open his doors to others. And a couple weeks before then, I had been at a makeshift shed on the south side of town where a couple was living, and I was taking them propane for their heater. And when I got there, the wife pulled me in, and she was so proud, and she said, I want you to see what we've done with the place. We've made a guest room here. And she had a plywood, you know, that separated the guest room from their main area. And they found like bedding and mattress and washed it, laundered it. They had a guest room for people. And she was like, I always do what we can when it's so cold to take care of the people around us. And we make sure we always have an extra bed for people. And so we gave them extra supplies so they could give it out to others. But here's the deal. I've worked on the streets for 11 years, and I've seen more radical love and radical hospitality on the streets than I've seen for most of our churches.
Right.
And it humbles me. It challenges me. It teaches me. I have seen people with the least open up their hands, everything they have open to others. And I've seen people with the most close their hands and hoard it off.
Yeah.
The light that I see, the idea of mission work is to take the light with you to the darkness or whatever. Here's the deal. The light's already there. It's already in people. It's already active and at work. We're bearing witness to it. We're drawing it out. We're trying to give it space to breathe and support it. And I want people to know that the folks that I work with can't just be dismissed. They have stories and they have gifts and capabilities and resiliencies. And they have changed my life and helped to liberate me and change me. And I'm thankful for that.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, and you're right. Like, I love, thank you for sharing that, because it just makes me think of kind of the average American desires to have a guest room in their house, right? I want to have this guest room, and I have all these rooms. And if we have these guest rooms that, for the most part, sit empty.
Right.
And yet, here we have story after story of people who just recently received space.
Yeah.
And who are already willing to open up their space.
Yeah.
And that's just, It's so fascinating. And I think you touched on something that people don't realize is that when they see folks who are on the street at night in the winter, the average person probably thinks, I know we have shelters in Nashville. These people should be in one of the shelters in Nashville.
Right.
I know that we do Room in the Inn. These people do Room in the Inn. But what you said, and you kind of, it's kind of an off comment, but is those places are often crowded.
Yeah.
And overcrowded. And for some, they have anxiety issues and other things happening where they can't, being in that space does more harm than it does good. And so they're kind of like left to kind of like roam the city in winter nights.
Yeah.
Like, is that, you know, you want to speak any more to that?
Yeah, I'll just say that until you talk to people and really hear where they're coming from, it's easy to judge them, but I would advise you not to, as all of us.
Right.
But yeah, there's so many people that can't fit into our shelter system that have barriers to some of our services. You know, couples can't stay together in our shelter systems
That's right.
Our typical shelter systems. People with pets. If you have a pet or you have a partner and you lose everything in your world, are you going to want to split up from them at night? That's your one connection with sanity, with your life before, with stability. So there's a lot of reasons why people have barriers to some of those services. It's really easy for us to impose what we would do onto other folks without hearing where they're coming from. But I think listening is a spiritual practice, listening and having non-judgmental compassion upon the people we meet.
Yeah. So here's what I want to ask. This is going to lead to ultimately a question, I think, about self-care. But before I get to that, I want to ask, so you and your husband, you're married. You both are actively involved in this work, justice work. What is it like? Has relationships, friendships, family interactions, you know, outside of the people that are your friends that are on the street or have come out of the street recently, like, what are those relationships like? Do friends try not to, like, oh, if I talk to Lindsay and Andrew, they're going to be trying to convince me to go, you know, like, do you feel like, have you felt the pull away or the embracing or a little bit of both, or what's that like? Because what you're doing, like, you're all in, like, there's no, like, oh, we're kind of doing this thing on the side. It's like, no, this is our work.
Yeah.
Does that make
sense? The work of justice is our work. It's what we're called to. It's our life's work. And it will take our lives and probably many more generations. Things are pretty bleak at the moment, or at least sometimes they feel that way. But yeah, I would say a little bit of both for sure. You know, we have our community that is in this work alongside of us and supports us. And we've been a part of other communities in the past where we've been like a bridge between the communities that are a little bit more disconnected from the ground. Maybe they do other types of work and just aren't quite there with the justice stuff. We've been a bridge we are still a bridge to a lot of those communities, but we've also been trampled as a bridge, or at least I've felt that. And we are on the side of the poor and the oppressed and the marginalized and the people who are outcast, and that is the side we've cast our lot with, you know. So it does make some relationships interesting, but we also try to practice compassion with everybody we meet. My philosophy is to meet everybody where they are, and that means the corporate executive that's in the very wealthy church. I need to meet him where he is, and I also need to meet that person that's just getting out of jail where they are on the streets. So we try to practice that philosophy and always have openness and always try to listen before we speak and seek to understand before we seek to be understood. But some of my friends who are just living their lives that have and are completely disconnected from the struggles for justice, there has been some gaps there because we don't have as much to relate on. Which is normal, right?
Have you watched Project Runway? It's like, maybe, but it's like, I'm also like, trying to keep people alive. Hello.
The winters are like that. Yeah, we're like every winter, night we're like trying to keep people alive.
The summers are probably a little bit different, perhaps, but they're still struggle because it's the heat can get really bad out there. But
So there's a difference, but you have to stay open to everybody and have to be willing to see the light in everybody wherever they are and try to draw that out, because transformation can happen wherever people are. We're about that personal transformation, that open hearts and minds. We're also about the systemic transformation. So you can't do one without the other. You have to be a part of both, I think, at least for it to really take.
So, okay, that's an interesting question. We're going to get self-care, I promise. But but I'm interested, like, okay, so you said remain open because transformation can happen with, you know, at random, mysteriously. So my question would be, have you seen that in an individual or in a system that once was here, but now it's been transferred to be over, transformed, and now it's over here? And perhaps that person, individual, that system, that whatever has become the thing you think on and remember and like kind of, it keeps you going, right? Totally. It's like the win of like, I've seen this, I know this is hard, transforming these people, opening, educating them, but I know it works because of this. Yeah.
Totally. I mean, I could point you to any number of our interns or, you know, one of my good friends, I'll use her as an example. Her name's Jeannie, and she was a corporate attorney back in the day. She started catching wind of some of the same stuff that transformed me and stepped away from her work and went to a monastery in Georgia for a while, and has been working for issues of homelessness and prison abolition ever since. And prison abolition is not just reform, but like really changing the system. Yeah. But I mean, you know, we just had a volunteer out with us the other night that was coming on the streets with us on one of the cold nights. And she was like, you know, before I came out here, I had no idea what this was like. She was like, my eyes will never be the same. I'm getting my people at work involved. Like, she's become one of the people that's getting some of the donations for us, that's trying to raise money, that's coming alongside us. And we've had people at every level accompany us, whether they were students or they were, like, we have some CEOs and foundations that have come alongside us to say, as a nonprofit, you need to keep your doors open.
Right.
Like, how can we give what we have to accompany you?
Yeah, it's good.
And that work of accompaniment is what we do with our friends on the streets, but it's also what faith communities and other people, individuals in the community do with us. We're so thankful for that. We couldn't do what we do without that. But yeah, I would have to have a really long time to tell you all the transformations. We have had
but
wins,
you've had
too.
Some. Yeah, you've had the wins.
And the wins are few and far between, but they are there and they matter. And sometimes it's just on an individual getting them through the barriers and the hoops.
Right.
And other times it's changing city policy or beyond.
Yeah.
And it does help you keep going. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You got to have that.
A lot of losses, too.
Yeah, you got to have. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
So self-care.
Self-care.
So talk to me about what that road has looked like for you, because I can imagine that early on in this work, you were like, psh, I got this. I can do all the things all the time, everywhere, anytime. Can't be stopped.
Oh, man.
But eventually you mature and go a little older and you're like,
the invincibility of youth, right?
Yes. Yeah, holy cow. All the energy. I can stay up to 3, wake up at 7. Let's do this thing.
Let's do it. Yeah. So I realized it actually took me a few pretty stubborn years of some unhealthy habits of realizing that if I was going to stay in this work for the long haul, that I had to figure out a way to do it sustainably.
Yeah.
And that was a really bumpy road. It's an ongoing struggle, if I'm really honest, to keep that balance and to really remember that my wholeness matters too, and my partnership and marriage with Andrew matters too, and my relationships matter too.
Right.
It was actually some of the people on the streets who taught me that. Some of my friends on the streets, were some of the first to kind of like give me permission to care for myself. They were like, Miss Lindsay, we see those bags under your eyes. we need you to keep going. We need you to stay healthy because we need you.
Right.
And they would be like, we got this. Like, you need to take some time off. And it was not only that, but there's this really amazing poem by Judy Brown that's called Fire. And she says, you know, we were talking about fire earlier, but she says in that poem, what makes a fire grow is the space between the logs, a breathing space. You pack on too many logs and it's going to shut down the fire just like water would. So
that's right.
So, so kind of having permission, remembering that my wholeness matters, kind of moved me into a place of remembering that rest is a spiritual practice, contemplation, meditation, breathing. These are spiritual practices that feed my soul. Sabbath, practicing Sabbath is not only a commandment for some of us, but theologian Walter Brueggemann says, you know, practicing Sabbath is an act of resistance to a world that says you are only worth what you produce. You are not enough until you empty yourself again and again and again and have nothing left except for the tasks you're doing. And that spoke to me as a three. I'm a three on the Enneagram.
Oh, yes, that is, that's
and that
good.
Cut deep to me because, I realize that Sabbath is resistance. So self-care to me has looked like having breathing spaces. It's looked like walks in the woods at Radnor. It's looked like mornings where I journal. It's looked like retreats to the Abbey of Gethsemane, which is a monastery nearby in Kentucky, and going on a silent retreat and kind of reconnecting with the rhythms of the earth. It's looked like gardening, being attentive to the seasons, for me, the actual seasons where it's cold or where it's hot, but also the liturgical seasons like Advent and Lent, and that rhythm has grounded me. So so those are kind of some of the ways. But I'll also say that a way that I care for myself is doing this work in community. Mm-hmm. Nobody can do this work alone, whether you're just trying to serve or you're doing the movement building work of justice. It requires community and connection. And I've learned to care for myself in relationships and community. And so we're always trying to take care of each other. Hey, we got you. You take this time off. Like, thanks for covering me last time. This work requires community. You will fizzle out alone.
So, I want to go back a little bit. I just thought about this. And one question I had. So you did AmeriCorps.
I did.
Which, I'm sure you have all kind of hot takes, cold takes on that work and all of that, which if you want to say anything about that, you can. But I'm really interested in, okay, so you do AmeriCorps. You get done, then you go to Vanderbilt.
Mm-hmm.
Why divinity school for you? And why not social work? Or why not psychology? Or why not, there's so many other different paths you could have taken post that work, even though you kind of said, I'm going to work my life in street ministry in this kind of world. Why that versus the other things you could have did?
Yeah, I was recruited for a while by somebody at in a community development and action program. And, you know, she was like, you know, change happens through research. Like, you need to come here. We need you here. And I kept hearing her and being like, yes, that's one mode of change. But for me, like, something is calling to me about this work of theology. There's something, the center for me wasn't research. It was it was God and this sense of spirituality. So theology over, since it was, since the early church was born and then grew and became an empire religion, right? In Christianity, at least.
Absolutely.
Theology has been used to oppress folks. God has been used to exclude, to oppress.
Yeah.
And I wanted tools. I was so hungry for tools that I wasn't getting anywhere else. I wasn't even getting from a lot of the churches I was a part of.
Yeah.
To say, like, help me understand how this God you say is a God of love is excluding these kind of folks because of XYZ. Why am I excluded as a female just because I'm not male? I wanted tools to understand that, and I wanted to channel that work and that understanding to mobilize the faith communities. You know, I do interfaith work, so the only conversion I'm interested in is converting Christians to Christianity. like if you're a Muslim, I want you to be the best Muslim you can,
right,
okay? Like,
yeah,
we can learn from each other.
Yeah.
But if you're a Christian and you say you're following this super radical, homeless, like, brown, Palestinian, Jew, working class dude, right?
Yeah.
Then, like, where our lives should be looking different.
Yeah.
One of my heroes, Dorothy Day, was like, she was the founder of the Catholic Worker Movement. She was like, if you have two coats in your closet, one belongs to the poor. Like, why don't we see more Christians living like that? Why aren't we living more like that? So though it was a calling for me, like it was something that was eating me up, like that fire in my mm-hmm. bones that
yeah,
if I was
that's right.
to walk away from, it would have consumed me. I had to follow that. Certainly being, having a theology degree isn't super lucrative, right? None of this work is. You're not in it for the money. Okay. But there's so much meaning. There's so much fulfillment. And that, for me, I had to figure out where my core was, and that's where it was. Those are the questions I needed answered yeah. or I couldn't sleep at night.
So, and I guess, just kind of curious, like, is there ever moments that you wish that, like, you know what, I wish that I did just make a ton of money so I could just give it all away and I could do so much if I just, like, did it. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
it's, now, granted, that's with the mindset that you have now. Like, if you went on the path to do that, to make all the money you could possibly make, maybe you get to that space still. And maybe you still think about it in the way you think about it now. But I you know, like, have you ever just been like, man, let me just go and just go make a bunch of money and just so I could throw it out there to all my peoples, you know?
Man, I hear people wrestling with that all the time. And I'm like, I don't know what that's like. Listen, there is something, money is not meaning.
Sure.
And like, yeah, our movements need funding. So if that's your gift, if that's what you have, if that's your calling, you're responsible to that.
Yeah, it's good.
For me, money keeps me away from the relationships and the on-the-groundness and the vulnerability of doing this work, of changing myself. If I had too much, I don't trust myself to use it well. I would think I would be like, well, I need, you know, nicer vacations. I need more clothes here. I don't trust myself to do that. If that's something people are called to, then they can take that up, you know,
sure.
with whatever.
Sure,
there's
sure,
that
sure.
parable about, you know, the rich man and entering the kingdom of heaven, and it's easier for a camel to get through the eye of a needle, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's the book of James that is super scary that I don't think a lot of people read in the Bible. That's like, you know, the moths will eat your flesh, and like the fire will consume all your possessions and everything.
And that was Jesus' brother.
That was
chill,
some crazy
bro.
Stuff. He was pretty uptight about the whole wealth thing. So I'm not going that far. You can take that up with James too. But I am saying, I think there's something about wealth, and there's something about being insulated from the poor when there's so much poverty and so much suffering that maybe some of us, and certainly I've experienced this, would find a little bit more of our liberation and salvation when we do open our hands wider and give a little bit more. And so for me, that's never been a choice. My place is with the people, and I hope that I always have enough integrity to stay there and be there and try to walk that line. But I go home at night when my people are still out.
Yeah.
And that is real. And
yeah.
I wrestle with that. But I'm working for a world where everyone has housing. And that includes you, and that includes me, and that includes my people.
Right.
So always keeping that in view.
Oh, good. So what, you want to say something, Ben? Oh, okay. So street chaplaincy.
Yeah.
How did you get there? Like, so you do the MDiv, and now you say, well, let's be a street chaplain.
So I didn't know street chaplains could exist, right? So
right.
I'm doing the work with AmeriCorps, and I'm seeing the social workers and the outreach workers being so connected to the people that are so cast out of our society, and they're so on the ground. And then I go to divinity school, and I'm seeing these pastors do really beautiful pastoral care where they're working toward healing with people. They're opening up space for people to, like, make meaning in their lives. It's so powerful. But there's this disconnect. Like, the pastors weren't, there's barriers to people who could get to the pastors. They had to have institutional access.
Right.
So I didn't see that pastoral care, that wholeness work being accessible to my people. But I didn't see the social workers being able to do that work of wholeness. They're able to do that, those transactions where you're like, let's get you healthcare and let's get you housing and let's get you food box. And that's important too. But the street chaplaincy, when I heard about the street chaplaincy thing, one of my friends in the world of outreach was like, hey, Lindsay, you should look up this dude in Seattle who's doing this, a guy named Craig Rennenbaum. I looked him up and I was like, this is a thing. It combines all of my worlds. It's beautiful. And so I started exploring it. You know, I was doing a lot of activism at the time through Occupy Nashville, a local manifestation of Occupy Wall Street. And there was a lot of talk about protest chaplains too, like having caregivers for these places that are often abandoned, and where wholeness and self-care and spirituality matter. Like, we need whole people doing our movement work. Mm-hmm. We need to care for them. We need to care for our folks on the streets, and we need to walk with them through the end of life process, certainly. So I started looking things up and I got really excited. And I wrote a grant to get me to Seattle to study with this dude, Craig. I went out there, and then I brought that back and did a proposal. And some people in some churches were crazy enough to fund me. I went through a pastoral education program called CPE, Clinical Pastoral Education. They were crazy enough to let me be a street chaplain alongside hospital and jail and hospice chaplains and train me in it.
Wow.
And it's, for me, it's a ministry of both presence and accompaniment.
Yeah.
Both sharing the suffering of people and giving that space to breathe and to heal, and also struggling alongside people in practical solidarity. And that's doing that justice work. That's saying when the cops come to close our friends' campsites, we say, if you arrest them, you're arresting us. And we help people organize. That's the solidarity work. That's the accompaniment work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's... the work of healing is multifaceted, right?
That's
our
right.
People and us, we all need it's like the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, mm-hmm. right? We need our physical needs met. But if we're going to get to that place of self-actualization or whatever you want to call it, then that wholeness place that we're all kind of journeying toward and hungry for, we've got to have people that can, I don't know, be present to our souls and our spirits and accompany us in that. And our people are just the same on the streets.
Yeah, and I think it's so interesting that, you know, they're, even though these men and women have through a variety of circumstances, are living on the street, there's still so many of them that still have faith.
I am so... the faith that I've seen on the streets, again, it's like the hospitality and the love,
right.
I was talking about. You know, I go through an ankle injury and my whole faith starts to crumble, right? You go through a breakup in your life,
right.
Or you go through, you know, you lose a loved one or whatever. And
yeah.
You're like, where is God?
Yeah.
The people I've been with on the streets have experienced more loss than I will probably ever know in my life, hopefully ever know. You know, I just lost a man who I'd known for 6 years, journeyed with him through hospice, and he just passed away. But, you know, he had had a hell of an upbringing. He made it out of that, survived the upbringing, and then lost his daughter and his granddaughter in an accident, a car accident, and
wow.
Then lost his wife after that, and then hit the streets and got lung cancer and still had faith. He was like my example. I was like... I'm struggling in my faith because of this, like, cold or whatever. And
yeah.
he's like,
well, here we are.
And people are like, I just saw somebody on the streets that yesterday, a guy named Dave who needed a tent because his tent burned down. And he was like, I had a tent in my car. And he was like, I had been praying to God and I knew God would answer my prayer because God always provides for me wherever I am. And I'm like, Dave, like, holy cow. He's like, I think God brought you to me. And I was like, maybe God brought you to me.
Me, yeah.
but the faith is amazing. Wow. Again, it's that upside down concept of missions where actually we are healed by the relationships because of the profound faith and the profound love I encounter on the streets. Again, I don't want to romanticize it. There's a darkness there that all of us have.
Yeah.
And so many struggles, but there's an astounding light as well. And that's what I keep being drawn back with. The relationships are amazing and transformative.
So what are kind of the things looking kind of forward, ahead, you know, what are the things you're kind of excited about? Like, what are the things you're kind of filling your energy with these days?
Yeah. So I'm doing a little bit of writing, which has been really fun, but we're always looking forward to ending homelessness and working ourselves out of a job. So that's kind of our ultimate goal.
Good. I'm glad you brought that up. So what if a local church came to you and said, Lindsay, we want to hire you full time to be one of our pastors, one of our ministers? Like, is that like a hard no, or is that like a let me discern and think about this? Like,
yeah.
And maybe that's happened. Maybe you've gotten offers before and
Well, right now, my place is with Open Table Nashville. That nonprofit has my heart, and we certainly have our struggles. But I mean, you know, I think there are seasons in life, right? Like right now, my season is with Open Table, and I hope it will be for a very long time, and maybe forever. Who even knows?
Sure.
But I want to work with churches and every faith community and every organization to try to help them figure out how can they be involved in homelessness and even what we call collective liberation, which isn't just about housing justice, but it's about racial justice, economic justice. It's about the rights of all the people that have been cast out. How can they be involved in meaningful, sustainable ways to not just perpetuate those cycles by charity, but to break those cycles and to transform themselves? Because we all have things in us that could grow and change. But we need their help. Like, I heard somebody say the other night, he said, I think it was something I was listening to, maybe online, but he said, you know, right now the world is on fire and we all have our water bottles. And if two of us or three of us or 100 of us pour our water out on the world on fire, we might get some sizzles, but it's not going to make a difference. It's going to keep burning. Mm-hmm. But enough of us come together and we use our water bottles. And I would add, maybe if we can like figure out where the hoses are and tap them too or whatever. But he was saying, if enough of us pour out our water bottles on this fire, if we can get enough people in this work, everybody doing their part, then that's what's going to move the needle. We have to be more open. We have to all do what we can. You're an accountant? Great. Bring your skills. You're a lawyer. You're a doctor. You're a physical therapist. You know, you're a teacher, whatever. Bring your skills to this work. We need you in it. Mm-hmm. So when we mobilize enough people and end homelessness.
Sure. Yes. Yes.
And I truly believe another world is possible. And that fuels me like nothing else.
That's good.
I believe another world is possible and that we can end this. Maybe not in my lifetime. Then, that's my ultimate goal. Then we could not have outreach workers, and then I could garden, and then I could be just hang out with people by a river or something, by some bonfires.
All right.
But our work is really about caring for each other. There's Movement Chaplaincy, which is a new thing that's coming.
Okay.
That more people across the country are in pockets are kind of talking about. That's caring for our frontline social justice people and providing spiritual soul care to them and sustainable care so they can keep sustaining their really important work of changing our systems. That's been a really exciting conversation.
Yeah,
so
that's great.
There's a lot of good things going.
Huh.
Yeah, it's been fun.
That is fun.
Keeps you busy.
Okay, cool. So we're about to be done. So I'm trying to think what we need to cover anything before we go to the speed round. Anything we missed or we should?
Not that I can think of.
That you want to share? Okay.
I could talk forever, so I'm not going to do that to you or y'all.
No, this has been it's been really good. Okay, so let's do a speed round.
Oh man.
So it's just random questions. Here we go. Random questions for Lindsay. Favorite Nashville restaurant?
Hermitage Cafe, which is this little hole in the wall off Hermitage Avenue. They have chicken biscuits that remind me of my grandmother's.
What was that one place in South Carolina? I keep forgetting the name of it.
Oh, it's The Beacon.
The Beacon.
Oh my God, I can't believe you knew about that.
You had told us about it. Remember?
No,
me and
I don't.
Richard, we met you at The Beacon.
That's right.
Like years ago.
It's like that, but it's tiny hole in the wall.
Yeah.
Not many people know about it, so don't have a lot of people listen so they know about it.
The Beacon's going to be so excited. They may be a sponsor now.
The Beacon and Hermitage Cafe. Shout it out.
Okay. Favorite, so you listen to podcast.
Yes.
Favorite podcast right now.
On Being and Healing Justice have been really healing my soul and helping me stay alive and on fire. Yeah.
Yeah. Have you had any music you've been really into lately? Like who, artists or?
Good question. Yes. I'm trying to think. I've actually been listening to Tom Waits lately.
Nice.
Who's like genius of the carnivalesque and super gritty and sounds like his voice was like soaked in bourbon for a while.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
he has some really great, really interesting stuff thinking about theology, this upside down world, underground. And it's been really fun to listen to him. Yeah.
That's awesome. And then last thing I'll ask is, tell us about, it can be any time, but a time you experienced or saw something and it was like, it was a wow moment. Like after you experienced it, after you saw this thing or heard this thing, your response was, wow.
Certainly the story I told earlier about the radical hospitality I've experienced.
Yeah.
Trying to think.
Like another wow.
Another wow moment.
Yeah.
You might have to edit this a little.
No, it's like just another wow moment where you, after seeing and experiencing it.
You know, I remember, so there's a picture that's been passed around a lot lately of, you know, a mother just across the border pulling two of her young children in diapers away from tear gas.
Mm-hmm.
And right beside that photo was this really beautiful piece of artwork that I saw that had, you know, Mary, Joseph, the donkey, and baby Jesus fleeing from the violence of Herod and the, you know, mass killing of the infants, fleeing that violence and going to Egypt. And I thought, if more Christians realized we served a refugee God, a homeless God, I think we'd be having some very different conversations in this country right now. And that was a wow moment for me. I had heard that, I knew that, but seeing those two pictures next to each other just made it so much realer. Like, yeah, that baby was Christ in a diaper. We are turning away Christ when we are closing our doors, when we are closing our hands. And that's something, again, I think we're going to have to answer to in this world or the next. And I hope we do. So that was a wow.
Wow.
Might be a darker wow. But such is my
such
life,
a wow.
Right?
Lindsay, thank you.
Thanks
thank
for
you.
Having
all
me.
All right,
this is
thanks.
Fun.
We'll see y'all.